Rwanda is known as the Land of a Thousand Hills.
It is a very difficult country in terms of topography, and many areas are hard to reach.
The time to order and get the supplies by truck is just too late.
There's no way that we can overcome the time that it takes to get anywhere during the rainy season.
The best case scenario, it would take at least 4 hours.
These are Rwandan officials and international experts talking about a problem that's severe in Rwanda, but prevalent throughout the world. How do you get life-saving supplies to remote places? Now, this would be a challenge anyway if we were talking about food or water or medicine. But in this case, we're talking about blood. And it's blood that is desperately needed by mothers who are dying from hemorrhaging after childbirth. And that's one of the main causes of death among women in Rwanda. And the thing is, it's not a problem of supply, it's a problem of delivery. The roads in Rwanda are horrible. The blood isn't that far away. I mean, it's so close, it's as if you could hear the doctors pleading for it, but you're helpless to do anything about it. But someone did hear the pleading of those doctors, and they did try to do something about it, even though the challenge seemed impossible. I'm Mick Ebling, and this is Not Impossible. This is a podcast about people solving the hardest, most mind-boggling problems in some of the most creative and unimaginable ways. This podcast is brought to you by Avnet, a company dedicated to helping creators of all types find whatever they need to get from idea to product and then to get their product to market anywhere in the world. Today, we're going to visit with some people who challenge the very nature of what's impossible. But we also want to explore one really key question in the middle of all of this. The question is, why? I mean, who are these people who throw everything away to chase these impossible dreams? Who are these Don Quixotes, and what motivates them to go tilting at windmills? I mean, are they crazy? Case in point, Keller Rinaldo. He was this guy who had everything going for him. He started this company called Remotive.
I started the company when I was 23 in 2011, and we weren't really even intentionally creating a company. We were just selling these little robots you could plug your iPhone into.
The robot was called Romo. It looked like an 8-inch long tank with a slot on top of it for your iPhone to sit in. And before Keller knew it, his robot was a huge hit.
We like put it on Kickstarter, sold a bunch of robots, and then I ended up, like, we created this little assembly line in my apartment. We ended up mailing robots to people all over the world. And we actually sold more than $1 million worth of robots in the first year, which kind of blew my mind and was like, whoa, okay, suddenly it was a company.
Romo is cute. When you turn him on, his goofy face appears on the screen when Keller introduces him during a TED Talk.
When Romo wakes up, he's in creature mode. So he's actually using the video camera on the device.
You hear Romo making funny little noises in the background.
He's wary, so he'll keep his
eye. And he immediately wins over the crowd.
If I come over here, he'll turn to follow me. If I come over here. He's smart. Thanks, little guy.
Things were going well. His robot was a big hit, money was good, and it was just at this moment of success that Keller said he felt empty.
And I think the big realization for me was that people would pay for it and they were really excited by the idea, but people didn't really use those robots much more than a week. Like, they would buy it and use it a little bit and then get tired of it and put it on the shelf and not come back to it. And so for me, that kind of made me realize, man, like, if I'm going to invest my whole life in a project, the most important thing to me, it's not can I sell it for a lot of money? It's not can the company be profitable? It was more just like, are we building something that people really, really love and use all the time? And so that was actually for me this realization that, like, I kind of want to give up on that product.
And you just one day said, I got to do more.
Yeah, it was really, I mean, for me, it just came down to, you know, life is short. And if we're going to build something, we don't just want to build something that can, like, make money. We want to build something that will have a huge impact on people's lives. And when we really started approaching the problem from that direction, we were like, let's build something that would literally save lives. Let's build something that the world thinks is impossible.
And this may get at the idea of why people do these impossible things. For Keller, it's not just the challenge of building amazing things. He wants a bigger challenge. There's something in this that's both altruistic, but also kind of chemical. This is this guy whose comfort zone is being outside of his comfort zone. He needs the challenge as much as he wants to aim that need in a positive direction. And is that ego? Is that brilliance? Is it altruism? I think there's a mix. And I think that's at the heart of why people take on these impossible challenges. Whatever it was, he knew he couldn't do it alone. He would need a strong team, and he found the perfect partner.
Patty the Parrot says a letter sound.
Say the sound for this letter into my microphone.
This is Bam Boomerang, a reading app that's still popular today. It was created by an engineer named Keenan Wyrobic.
Bam Boomerang is an app for kids to learn to read. It was basically a mission to bring the stickiness of, you know, physics-based games like Angry Birds that sort of get kids hooked to a learn-to-read app. So kids play games, they read out loud, and volunteers over the cloud listen and give feedback, you know, through sort of a push-button interface. Pretty much everything I've done is some version of taking some really important problem and trying to take technology and make it magically solve the problem so people don't even know the technology is really behind the solution.
But Keenan was also on the hunt for a bigger challenge.
I have a hard time waking up in the morning unless what I'm doing is really exciting, literally. And, you know, finding something like this that really matters directly in terms of saving lives and just improving, just empowering doctors, it's just so meaningful to me.
That's something turned out to be an idea called Zipline. Keenan and Keller set out to completely change the way blood and medical supplies get to people who need them in places that can be hard to reach. It makes those deliveries using drones. And Keller says at the beginning, connecting healthcare and drones was a really tough sell.
I mean, in 2014, when I started talking a lot, saying, hey, we really want to build, you know, instant delivery for healthcare, we think we could use drone delivery to deliver medicine to people who are dying, a lot of people looked at me funny because the assumption was like, that's technologically impossible. Nobody's going to pay for it. You won't be able to do it at scale. Like maybe you can do one flight, but it's not going to be nearly reliable enough. The planes are going to crash. You'll only be able to do a couple flights. So we had so many layers of skepticism.
I was hoping that someplace in your office, you had some of those kind of those cheap little army men that you grab their parachutes and the army men, you throw them up in the air and they parachute down. And that I was hoping that there was one day you were out there sitting on a bluff, throwing it up in the air and throwing it down and throwing it up in the air and catching it. And that was the, oh my God, we could do this with blood. This is incredible. But it sounds like it was more of these realizations of you wanting to push and do a little bit more.
We really had a sense for like, we had a special team. We knew we could build something hard and we wanted to go work on something that we'd be really proud to work on for the next 20 years of our lives. And so we wanted to make sure we were tackling a problem that was kind of so audacious or so difficult that it would take a long time to solve. And when we really started approaching the problem from that direction, we were like, let's build something that would literally save lives. Let's build something that the world thinks is impossible. And that really was what led us towards Zipline.
And Zipline leads us to Rwanda. Most of us became focused on Rwanda back in 94, when conflict between the Hutus and the Tutsis in the country resulted in genocide. 800,000 people died.
UN officials say they have never seen anything like it. In just the last 24 hours, more than 250,000 people have fled Rwanda and its terror.
If you stopped paying attention after that, you wouldn't recognize the country now. It has a bustling tourist trade that attracts nearly 1 million visitors a year. It's considered a safe place to visit, and it's in the middle of a domestic tourism program called Remarkable Rwanda. But one thing hasn't changed in the country that's called a land of 1,000 hills, and that is the roads that cross those hills.
Well, in some of the roads in rural areas, they are not paved, they are not tarmacked, so in the rainy season, they can't get muddy.
This is Jean-Philbert Nsengamana. They call him Minister Phil. As much as anyone, he's the symbol of the new emerging Rwanda. He was the country's Minister of Youth until that was combined with its Ministry of ICT, Information and Communication Technology. Youth and technology put him in the middle of this problem of how to deliver blood to young mothers in these rural hospitals. Our Skype connection from Rwanda was a little shaky, but what he had to say was really clear.
It takes sometimes 4 hours to be able to get something that is uniquely available in a certain location to the location where it is needed. And as we all know, in a case of emergency, 4 hours, you know, even 1 minute can be the difference between life or death.
And just by chance, this is where Keenan and Keller came into the picture.
We were getting really interested in logistics and spending a lot of time looking at places in the world where logistics tends to break down.
Keller Rinaldo.
And so I naturally began to look at places that don't have great roads and was spending time in different parts of East Africa, Tanzania, Uganda, and eventually Rwanda. And in Rwanda, in talking with the Ministry of Health, we started to learn a lot about how blood logistics works and why it's so super challenging. They deliver about 65,000 units of blood a year. 50% of that is going toward moms who are suffering from postpartum hemorrhaging right after giving birth. But the challenge with blood is that it doesn't last very long. It has all these complicated storage requirements and thermal requirements. And so when you're trying to get it out to all these different rural places, it's basically an unsolved supply chain problem. And so the way that they were operating the system was asking doctors when a mom is in trouble, for example, having a doctor get into a car and drive to a blood bank. And that can take several hours to get there, and then wait at the blood bank, get the blood, and then drive several hours back. And so what we realized talking with the Ministry of Health was we could solve that problem in a much more efficient way.
Minister Phil was thrilled when he heard the idea.
It's also an issue of mindset. I think that here in Rwanda, we've got a mindset which is we've lost enough lives in this country. We've lost enough time in our development. If we see something that has a promise to help us move very fast where we want to get, we go for it. And when we put our heads and minds and hands to something, we tend to give it our best.
But governments are governments, and bureaucracy is bureaucracy. And so to cut through it, Keller had to rely on a principle that we at Not Impossible like to fall back on. Just keep moving forward, because it's always easier to ask for forgiveness than to ask for permission.
Never ask for permission, because the answer will always be no. At no point
so
in my
true.
Life have I ever asked for permission and not had the answer be no. Because, like, whoever you're asking for permission from will always, like, there's nothing in it for them to say yes, generally.
So
and it's
true.
Always much better to say no. So we really more take the perspective of we go to people who need to be informed of what we're doing or who are ultimately going to need to give us like regulatory sign off. And we say, this is what we're going to do. And this is why it's extremely safe.
And in the back of your head, you're like, oh, shit, I sure hope this works. But that coming in with that level of confidence, obviously you do your homework, you do your research, you do your prototyping, your testing, but coming in with that level of confidence gives everybody else confidence. Everyone wants it to work as opposed to trying to prove that it doesn't work. So I could not agree more that people are wired to say no if you give them that option to, but if you take that option away, they're wired to say yes. So it's really in terms of how you deliver it.
Yeah. Yep, totally. And that's exactly what we've seen. And when we initially went to Rwanda, it was not coming from a permission. It was not coming from a state of going to the government and saying, hey, we have this awesome idea. Like, we want to do this. It was more like learning about their problems. And then they were the ones who basically insisted to us. I mean, we went in and said, like, here are a bunch of ways we could help. And they were like, shut up. We don't want any of that. Just do blood.
Just do blood. But how? We'll tackle that one after the break. Okay, let's face it. This is a podcast dedicated to technology for the sake of humanity, but it's also about the people behind that technology. If that's you, Avnet can help, no matter what you build. Why? Because they are the first company ever to offer true end-to-end solutions for product development in-house. That way, creators in any corner of the world can take an idea from prototype through to mass production,
Are you a startup, an established OEM? Do you need help designing your product or organizing your workflow or just getting your stuff to market? Avnet's got your back. Your world is one that's always changing. That's why Avnet is here to help you reach further. And we want to give a special shout out to Avnet's engineering communities, Hackster and Element 14. They help creators vet and invent the technology of tomorrow. Want to do something more than just listen to this podcast? Maybe something like, I don't know, taking on the next non-impossible challenge? Go to podcastnotimpossible.com to find info for you and for anyone who wants to take their project one step further. So Keenan and Keller set out to deliver blood by drones in Rwanda, and it was just as difficult as it sounds. But I like to think that every problem leads to another solution. And as it turns out, Keller thinks the same way.
So one of the principles that we have is this fail, 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 succeed, repeat as necessary, right? Walk us through some of those crazy problems or those deadlines or those things where you're just like, head in your hand, 17th coffee, trying to figure it out. Like, describe a couple of those if you could.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many, you know. When we originally kind of decided, okay, well, this, you know, what we're generally going to do is we're going to use a small robotic aircraft to deliver these crucial medical products in places that don't have roads so we can get there 20 times as fast. Every flight will potentially save a human life. And it seems simple because A, like, we're going to be able to buy lots of off-the-shelf components. B, we'll design, you know, some kind of recovery system so we don't need a runway. And therefore, we can get rid of the... we can get rid of the landing gear that you'd have to have on the plane. We'll design a launcher. We'll just put off the shelf battery packs in these planes so they can fly there and back easily. I am mentioning all these things because these are all things that turned out to be wrong. Okay, like when we got started, turns out that in the world of unmanned aerial vehicles, you can buy a $20 million Predator drone that only the U.S. military can afford, or there's like a $100 consumer drone that is super unreliable and made of plastic and falls out of the sky every 10th flight. And there's nothing in the middle. There's no like enterprise grade, commercial, like reasonable price, but really reliable. There's nothing there. And so we started by saying, well, we're going to use all these components. Turns out that's wrong. You're going to have to build it all from scratch.
And that's just what they did. They created flight computers and wrote software. They designed the wings and well, anything that goes into creating a drone, they created themselves.
You know, building a first version of something, you're always going to be wrong about half of your design assumptions, and you won't know which half that is until you're actually serving customers and putting products in people's hands, at which point you'll realize, wow, we wasted half of our time. And the other thing is that everything is always 10 times harder than you think it's going to be. And I remember this conversation with my co-founder, Keenan, and we were kind of like, well, you know what? Like, let's bang out the airplane. That'll be so easy. Let's just do that first. Let's get that done in a couple months, and then we'll focus on something more complicated. And like, thank God we decided that, because it turned out that was so much harder, and there was so much complexity and nuance in that problem that we thought was very easy, that had we chosen the more complicated thing, like the company would probably have died, because we would have run out of money before we had something to show or something that we could actually put in people's hands.
And so they kept working, and everything kept going wrong. And so they kept working.
I'm happy to talk about all of the crazy problems that we've had that have been really vexing and, you know, caused us to work crazy hours and through the weekends and implement crazy solutions. But I guess what I'm saying is that none of those super difficult challenges led us to think like, let's give up. And the reason was that we had this very clear need that we were hearing from, you know, these governments that we're working with, saying people are dying every day as a result of not getting access to these basic medical products. So when you know the need that well, there's like no option. Giving up isn't really an option. You're like, come hell or high water, we're going to figure this out.
And there was so much to figure out. Maybe you're thinking, well, I've seen drones. What's the big deal? Or maybe you have one. That drone is not this drone.
If you look at Amazon or Google, these other companies that are talking about drone delivery, they're using quadcopters.
Those quadcopters that you see everywhere, they don't go very far. These guys needed to build something that can travel long distances. So their drone actually looks a bit more like a plane with fixed wings.
We have about 20 times the range of a quadcopter. And when you have 20 times the range, that means you can serve 400 times the area, you know, because pi r squared.
The next problem that seemed simple and turned out not to be was, how do you power the thing?
It turns out you can't just take an off-the-shelf battery because the battery gets too hot when you're flying. Now, this isn't really an issue with quadcopters because quadcopters only fly for like 15 minutes. But, you know, to go and make deliveries to people who live pretty far away to serve the maximum service radius. So no one's really solved this problem of how do you thermally manage a battery to make sure that it stays cool when you're using that battery to power an airplane. And by the way, this is exactly the same problem Tesla had to solve with electric cars. And now we're having to solve it for the first time with electric airplanes. And that turns out to be a really, really hard problem that requires all kinds of new solutions.
The next problem was, how do you land the thing?
It actually just drops the product from about 30 feet in the air, which means that we don't have to have, you know, a runway or any kind of landing system or even like verify that people aren't going to touch the plane and get hurt or the plane's not going to get damaged when it lands.
So the plane didn't land where it drops off the blood, but it still had to land when it got back to home base.
It turns out to be a really zany solution where the plane is flying at about 80 kilometers an hour and it catches a wire and then the wire decelerates it and basically plops it onto a pad. But the cool thing about this solution is it allows us to recover planes in a really small amount of space very, very gently when the plane's moving really, really fast. Well, ironically, that's exactly how aircraft carriers solve that problem too. You know, when a plane comes and lands on an aircraft carrier, it basically is touching down on the deck. It has a hook that catches the wire and then the wire decelerates the plane.
So after only about, 2 years or so, they've got a working prototype. They call it the Zip. It weighs about 20 pounds, has a wingspan equal to a human wingspan, about 6 or 7 feet, and it's powered by a battery. And it looks and works like a little cargo plane.
It has a payload bay, which are these two little doors on its underbelly that can open up. When those doors open, we load the package in. The package is basically a shoebox. It's like a big shoebox that we can hold any different kind of medical product in. And it also has basically the cushioning required to deliver that medical product safely. So that shoebox gets loaded into the vehicle. The doors get closed. And then one of our flight operators will pick that airplane up and walk it to a launcher. And a launcher is really, it kind of looks like a catapult. It's a small catapult that will essentially accelerate the vehicle along a rail for about 12 feet. And when the vehicle leaves the end of that rail, it's completely autonomous and it's flying.
And there's one more concept you need to understand, a concept that guided the process all the way along. It's something Keenan told us is called fault tolerance.
Fault tolerance is a sort of a design principle of making, you know, basically planes like this that just always fly. And what it means is that when something has a failure or a fault and stops working, the system is tolerant to it. It doesn't care. It doesn't say, oh, okay, I lost that sensor, so I'm going to start going out of control and crashing. No, it deals with that fault, detects the fault, and then does the right thing to handle it in a safe way.
And that turned out to be the crucial ingredient, because after all this time, they had a plane that would work in theory. And when they took it out for its first test, it failed. But it failed in the best way possible.
We hadn't yet tested it in the air. And we had the team of investors from from Sequoia, which is one of the biggest and, you know, most prestigious investment firms in the world, coming to decide if they were going to invest in us. And live in front of them, we had one of the control services, right, one of the little services that flies the plane, just full on fail. And the plane flew beautifully, landed beautifully, and they didn't even know the failure had happened. That was a sweet moment, because, you know, when we think about what we're doing that really no one else has done, it's really achieving that level of reliability required to do this and where people live and do it responsibly.
Three, 2, 1, go.
And so then it was time to put Zip to the true test.
I think probably the most satisfying moment was our first delivery in Rwanda.
3, 2, 1, 1.
You're listening to a drone launch.
The satisfaction of doing that first delivery, having this team that's been working incredibly hard for about two years, just pouring everything into this and being able to sit there on my iPad and connect to what we call the controller user interface, the controller interface where I can see and oversee planes, and just getting to watch that plane while watching video of from our distribution center there in Rwanda, that plane just fly away, go out, make that delivery, fly back, land, and be ready for the next delivery was a magical moment. You know, it all of a sudden everything became incredibly real in a way that like only existed in our imagination for so long.
And suddenly they're making dozens of deliveries every day. All a doctor in Rwanda needs now to get blood is a cell phone.
If there's a mom who is at any one of these 21 hospitals that are within range of our distribution center in Rwanda, and she's suffering from postpartum hemorrhaging, the doctor can immediately say, if it will basically get her blood type, and then he can immediately send a text message saying, we need 3 units of AB negative blood, say. That order is received at the Zipline Distribution Center. We immediately pull that blood out of refrigerators that we have on site. It's loaded into a plane that's already passed pre-flight checks. The plane launches, and then it flies at about 100 kilometers an hour in a straight line, not dependent on roads or any other kind of access. We basically fly in a straight line to the GPS coordinates of that hospital. And then the doors on the plane open, the package is deployed, and we use a super simple little paper parachute that means that this package, instead of like, you know, coming down fast, it actually comes down in a really gentle, magical way, basically straight into the hands of the doctor. And then the doctor can immediately transfuse that blood into the patient and save her life. So it's super simple. It really is like send a text message, get what you needed 15 minutes later, save the patient.
And it's as easy as that.
Well, I've launched one myself.
This is Minister Phil again.
The countdown, and then you press on a button, then the drone goes in the air. But I want to tell you that the deliveries are happening as we speak. So imagine today what you have to do is to take your smartphone, you go to your app, you place the order, you specify which product you want, and in a matter of 15 to 20 or 30 minutes, you see the Zip dropping that product. It's like a miracle. So initially, the wow effect was like, wow, is it possible? It's miraculous.
And there's no telling how far this could spread, how many countries, how many lives, how many impossible challenges this could overcome. So miracles do happen, but they don't happen the way we used to think miracles happen. They happened, in this case, because of a concept we believe in at Non-Impossible. We call it beautiful, limitless naivete. If these guys had any idea how complicated this was going to be, they never would have gotten into it. Not knowing what you don't know can seem like a daunting prospect. It can seem cavalier. But if you let it, it can launch you. Like a catapult launches a drone. So that's our Not Impossible podcast for today. Thanks again to our sponsor, Avnet, a company that provides true end-to-end technology solutions to help people who make anything, anywhere in the world, reach further. And I want to invite you to check out their communities, Hackster, the world's fastest growing developer community for learning, programming, and building hardware, and Element 14, the biggest designer engineer community on the planet. You can find links to their websites on ours. Go to podcastnotimpossible.com to find info for you and for anyone who wants to take their project one step further. That's our podcast for today. Our senior producer for this episode was Jocelyn Frank. Our development director, Aaron Sullivan. Joe Babarski is our director of partnerships. Barking Owl Studios did our final mix. Vicky Shirer, our associate producer. Huge thanks to the team at Non-Impossible. And our executive producers are Phil Lerman and me. I'm Mick Ebling. Thanks for listening to Not Impossible. And until next time, remember, commit and then figure it out. Sounds crazy, right? Maybe. But it's not impossible.